From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. From the January 6th hearing, which is still going, we are getting some surprising insights into what's being called an unhinged six-hour meeting at the White House. That meeting was December 18th, hours before former President Trump tweeted asking his supporters to be there will be wild on January 6th. This afternoon, the committee is zeroing in on what former President Trump's advisors told him about seizing voting machines, among other ideas. And we're hearing for the first time what Pat Cipollone thought of this. He's the former White House lawyer who spoke to the committee last week.
To have the federal government seize voting machines, that's a terrible idea for the country. That's not how we do things in the United States. There's no legal authority to do that.
NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Ron, you're watching the hearing. What more are we learning about this meeting from December?
We're learning a great deal about how it evolved, how it began as an unscheduled and impromptu meeting, it appears, involving Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn and a fellow by the name of Patrick Byrne, who is known for his company Overstock, Inc. And this group had come in to tell President Trump that despite the fact that all his court challenges had failed, and despite the fact that the Electoral College had met several days earlier and elected Joe Biden the President of the United States under the Constitution, there were still things that perhaps could be done to reopen the question, to relitigate the election, to go here, to go there, to do this, to do that, to seize the voting machines, to perhaps declare martial law, so that Donald Trump could remain in office. And while this had been thoroughly looked at and debunked by every responsible member of the president's administration, these folks got in for a meeting, and they turned the president's head, it appears, or at least he was a willing listener to their theories.
Yeah. Does it appear that the president responded to what they were suggesting, that he was favorably inclined to doing what they were suggesting?
He was not satisfied with what he had been told by his own Attorney General, William Barr, or for that matter, his White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, whom we've been hearing from via videotape. Yes. He testified on Friday, and he has really been the star witness here this afternoon. And they were clearly telling him that it was over, that there was no meaningful evidence of fraud in the election, and he needed to make plans for after January 20th, when Joe Biden would be inaugurated the new and legal president. So this meeting went on lengthily on Friday of December 18th, was 4 days after the Electoral College, and just one day before Donald Trump still insisted on sending out that tweet, come to Washington on January 6th, gonna be wild.
Yeah. Pat Cipollone, the former White House lawyer, what else have we learned about what he told the committee?
Well, we don't know all of his testimony. It went on for a number of hours, but he seems to be quite forthcoming. He's not volunteering things without questions being asked, but he's being quite open in response to the questions. I think with probably more alacrity than many people were expecting. He's a very careful lawyer, very classic case of a White House lawyer who knows how to answer questions in a deposition without going too far or telling more than he needs to. This is someone who defended Donald Trump when he was impeached and has been the White House attorney for several years. And yet he is making it quite clear that he felt that this particular group of three who came in, met with the president on December 18th, including, of course, the National Security Advisor, former Michael Flynn, who had been convicted of lying to the FBI, seemed to really hit a chord, strike a chord of response with President Trump, and seemed to really influence his thinking thereafter. And as we could see, the president did try all kinds of ways to stay in office.
Yeah. The committee members have said that a big theme of this hearing was going to be connecting, was going to be links between President Trump and people in his orbit with the far-right groups that were part of the riot that stormed the Capitol. Have those links, those connections come up yet?
We have not yet gotten to those. We're expecting to hear from Jason Van Tatenhove, the former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers. He had left that organization where he was an employee several years before now and several years before the election. But we expect to hear from him as a kind of backgrounder on who the Oath Keepers are.
Yeah, well, get back to watching a lot we've learned already from this hearing.
Indeed.
NPR senior Indeed. Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Weeks after the Supreme Court ended federal protection of abortion rights, the FDA is considering making birth control more available. The French drug maker HRA Pharma is asking the FDA to approve the over-the-counter, no-prescription-needed sale of its birth control pill. While more than 100 countries have over-the-counter contraceptive pills, it would be a first in the U.S. Dr. Susan Wood is former Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health at the FDA. She directs George Washington University's Jacobs Institute of Women's Health Services. So, Dr. Wood, we know you support this idea. Why? And how big a deal is it if this comes through?
Well, I think we should think of it as it's one more option for preventing an unintended pregnancy. So in that sense, it is very good news. And I'll point out that it's got the support of the American Medical Association, the American College of OBGYNs, and the Academy of Family Physicians. There's a lot of support.
And we know dozens of House Democrats also signed a letter last March asking the FDA to conduct a timely review of any applications for over-the-counter birth control pills.
Mm-hmm.
But can you clear up a question just briefly? The HRA Pharma pill that we just mentioned is progestin only. That's a form of the hormone progesterone. Cadence Health is working with the FDA to move their pill to over-the-counter, and theirs is progestin and estrogen. What's the difference, and is it something that women should think about?
Well, I think, first of all, let's see if we can get this first one over the counter. The reason, you know, it's going through first is not just because they've done the studies already, but because there are fewer contraindications, that is, fewer reasons not to be taking this particular type. It has fewer side effects. And so it's easier for an average person to be able to read a label, take it correctly as is needed to make something over the counter, and it's very, very safe. However, there are many, many contraceptives which are called combined contraceptions. They have both progestin and estrogens in them. So, you know, getting some experience with the progestin only pill may help lead to getting a combined pill ultimately on the market as well. But this is a first step, and it's starting with the easiest and the safest version.
We know that birth control pills do carry a small risk of rare but serious blood clots.
Well, that actually goes along with the estrogen-containing ones. Mm-hmm. This is why the progestin only. It has fewer risks of side effects, and less than 2% of women of childbearing potential, you know, might have a contraindication, whereas a lot of other contraindications that might come into play if you were taking one with estrogen. So that's why, let's start with this one and see how it goes.
Right.
I think it will go quite well.
Well, and many people would point out that getting pregnant puts a woman at greater risk for clots than even a pill. But are you confident, though, that, you know, the question many people might have is, gee, over the counter, this is without consulting with your doctor, even though there's a small risk of something. You're confident that having a birth control pill over the counter without a doctor's guidance, you're comfortable with that?
I am. And I am for a number of different reasons. One is, you know, I don't think this is something that all women want to choose. It's going to fit a niche of women who are not already on a pill that they have talked to their doctor about. It might be for women who don't need to be on contraception regularly. It's going to be an emergency, your pill pack runs out. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be the be all and end all. And that's sort of why I said it's one more option out there.
Well, when I said that you were the former Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health at the FDA, we understand you resigned from the FDA years ago. And many people might remember there was a lot of foot dragging, a battle over age restrictions. Some people wanted them. There was one at first. You had to have a prescription if you were under 17 for an over-the-counter pill. There still was foot dragging. Now there is no age restriction. Do you worry about that? Because I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm thinking of the 13-year-old who, you know, following a sibling or a friend, goes and get themselves birth control pills and might have issues that a doctor might want to be aware of. Are you worried about that?
Well, I think, no. I mean, we went through a 10-year battle to get Plan B and all the other generic emergency contraceptive pills over the counter without an age restriction. And that's where it is today. And so having gone through that battle, and I won't rehash that, we have learned from it. And what we learned was it did not cause a problem. These hormonal emergency contraceptive pills are available to any age person who needs it. Similarly, we would learn from this, it's actually a lower dose of progestin. And if someone does need contraception, we want them to have access to it no matter what their age. It will be safe.
Because unintended pregnancies, as we have been hearing a lot lately, can be far more dangerous for women.
Absolutely. And who more than the very younger teens who, for whatever reason, are at risk of unintended pregnancy, we certainly want to help them prevent that unintended pregnancy because they are truly the most vulnerable.
Dr. Susan Wood, former Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health at the FDA and Director of George Washington University's Jacobs Institute of Women's Health Services. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade has a lot of people rethinking how they plan for their futures. But it might surprise you to know that there's an increase in people seeking vasectomies. Urologists across the country are seeing a surge in demand, according to the Washington Post. So let's talk to a man known truly as Vasectomy King. Dr. Doug Stein is a urologist in Florida, and he has performed tens of thousands of procedures. Dr. Stein, Your Highness, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. When you focus on something as much as I have, you kind of get the hang of it after a while.
Yes. And tell us, what was your practice like as far as demand before the Supreme Court decision and then after?
Well, we do not see men in visits preliminary to their vasectomy visit. They go to our website, they read over our vasectomy information page, and then if they like what they see, they can submit an online registration. And during the first 3 weeks in June, our numbers averaged 55 per week. Starting on the Friday that was June 24th, the number was 150. So it was virtually a tripling of the number of registrations that came in.
Dr. Stein, what do patients say about why they're signing up in such bigger numbers now? Do they mention the Supreme Court's ruling? Do they mention the concurring opinion from Justice Thomas on contraception? And some consider that potentially under a threat in the future?
Some did mention it to my staff, but with the calls coming in that quickly, my staff didn't spend too much time philosophizing with them. However, we have a policy in our office that my associate and I call all men who are less than 30 and have fewer than two children. We want to make sure that they're making a decision with which they're going to feel comfortable for the rest of their lives. And we noticed an increase in the number of men who are child-free, an increase in the number of men who are under 30. But if you take both of those two factors together, child-free and under 30, then the percentage of men doubled. When we evaluated the people who had their vasectomies in the last 3 months, which was about 850, versus the people who were scheduled, which was 536, over the next 3 months. So we're noticing this shift toward being child-free and being young.
Yeah. Boy, and hearing those numbers, you certainly do a lot of procedures, Dr. Stein. But what do you make of this demographic surge? What's going on?
It seems that there are three, maybe four rationales for calling at this time. First of all, almost nobody didn't think about a vasectomy on Thursday, but called for a vasectomy on Friday. These are almost all men who've been thinking about vasectomy for a long time, and the RV Wade overturn simply tipped them over the edge. Of the men who do that, they cite three, maybe four reasons. One reason is that, well, I'm in solidarity with my partner and with women in general. It's time for men to step up to the plate, and I didn't want to remain in the dugout anymore. Number two is the genuine sense of loss that there's no backup. In the event that a pregnancy occurs while they're using other forms of contraception, if there's a breakthrough with your partner when she's using birth control pills or even has an IUD in place. And that's the genuine fear that now we have no backup. And the last thought is what's going to be taken away from us next? Are they going to start outlawing vasectomies, or are they going to outlaw vasectomies in young men with no children? I don't think that's going to happen.
Setting aside your own business model, more business, but is more vasectomies, you think, good for society, more men appearing to take more responsibility for their role in family planning?
I hope so. I have been trying to promote male involvement in family planning for many years. Number one, I think it's fair to women to reduce the risks associated with their forms of contraception and with the unintended pregnancies that may occur when using those less dependable forms. But I hope that there's not an increase in the number of men making the decision prematurely. Social media has come out with the expression, oh, just get a vasectomy, it's reversible. Well, we don't look upon vasectomy as a reversible form of contraception. Yes, we do lots of reversals, and yes, reversals are often successful. However, they're not always successful. And therefore, to use the word reversible may put into a man's mind that vasectomy reversals are always successful, and that's not the case at all. So what the counter is that, well, doc, that may be true, but an unintended pregnancy now would be far worse in my life than a failed reversal at a later date.
That's Dr. Doug Stein, a urologist in Florida. Doctor, thanks so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, tribal governments are pressuring President Biden to make good on his pledges to uphold treaties in Indian country. Tribes there want 4 large dams removed from the Snake River in Washington state in order to protect the salmon, whose numbers are dwindling. NPR's Kurt Siegler reports.
Growing up, Shannon Wheeler heard stories passed down from elders about the enormous salmon runs here on this tributary, just a few miles upstream of the Snake River. Fish making the long journey up here from the Pacific to spawn were also huge and hardy.
Those are the types of stories even Lewis and Clark talk about. And we should know that a keystone species like salmon go extinct, well, who's next?
The Nez Perce are pushing for swift passage of a rare bipartisan bill before Congress. It would breach 4 dams, drain the reservoirs, and open up 140 miles of river for the fish to spawn in. A new report by the state of Washington estimates that could increase salmon runs 15-fold. For Wheeler, it's also about upholding treaties signed in the 1850s in which the U.S. government promised to protect his people's ancestral lands.
We ceded over 13 million acres to the United States of America. We aided the United States of America in its growth. All we're asking for is for the United States of America to uphold their responsibility and their promises.
Across the Northwest, dams are being removed lately with an eye toward species protection, but also cultural responsibility. Eunice Blavaskunas is an anthropologist at nearby Whitman College in Washington.
This region was settled in a way that cheated a lot of people. That reckoning is about recognizing indigenous people as political agents, as human beings with a long cultural legacy.
One, she says, that far predates the construction of the 4 Snake River dams, which started in the 1950s. But the Biden administration, with its carbon-free energy goals, is also in a bind. These dams provide enough power for some 800,000 homes, and barges along the river system dramatically reduce shipping costs for farmers, as they tout in this new ad.
The Pacific Northwest is the breadbasket for our region and the world. Keeping Snake River dams in operation is essential to keep our farms working.
Most wheat farmers here can't ship by rail, and barges are a lot cheaper than trucking. Ryan Poe farms in remote central Washington.
Obviously, I feel like breaching is, you know, just a catastrophic for a lot of us other users of these systems.
But Poe is also a sportsman and wants to see the salmon saved too. Taxpayers have spent millions over the years on hatcheries, fish ladders, even driving the fish in trucks around the dams. Tim Dykstra is a fisheries biologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which has long maintained the dams and salmon can coexist.
We have spent a great deal of effort to look at the dams and do our best to make the dams as invisible as possible to fish.
Federal officials say a high number of salmon survive passing through the four dams, but climate change and poor ocean conditions are also reducing their numbers. Still, the U.S. now has its first-ever indigenous interior secretary. Touring Idaho this month, Deb Holland said tribes are the original stewards of the land here, and close consultation with them is ongoing.
I think the salmon are incredibly important, and they have tremendous cultural and traditional meaning to Indian tribes across the West.
On the Nez Perce Reservation, Shannon Wheeler heard that as a sign that tribes are finally getting a voice in American politics.
We definitely feel that the needle is moving, and we definitely know that our concerns are making it to the highest levels.
He says they're ready to hold American leaders accountable. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Lapway, Idaho.
Gas prices could not be any higher, right? You should think again, because we are in the middle of a worldwide energy crisis, according to an influential voice. Fatih Birol heads the International Energy Agency. It's a powerful voice on all things energy, fossil energy, renewable energy. He spoke today in Australia.
The world has never witnessed such a major energy crisis in terms of its depth and its complexity. It is interwoven by many factors, including the geopolitics. And I believe we might not have seen the worst of it yet.
He calls this crisis deep and complex. So let's talk it through with Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
Good. Okay. Winter is coming, says a show I've never watched. Fatih Birol is worried about the winter in Europe specifically. What could be in store for Europe, given the price of oil, given that natural gas from Russia could slow to a trickle or even shut down?
There's a lot of fear and loathing right now because, look, it is very hot and you have the luxury of not thinking about it. But what if Russia, what if Putin puts the thumb back on the pipes? I mean, he played around with kind of Gazprom pipes earlier this week to kind of channel that, listen, I can cut you guys off. He's used it as a weapon geostrategically in the past with other Eastern European countries. And Europe tends to be green-minded, at least Western Europe, and there was a shift even away from nuclear, and coal is taboo. And suddenly, if you have to espouse these things, because unlike the United States, you're not sitting on oceans of natural gas, it sets you back in many different respects.
Yeah, and I mean, he says this is a global energy issue and shortage in many areas. I mean, we expect a new iPhone to come every year, but these energy markets, I mean, they move slowly, right? Is that part of the problem here?
They do move slowly, and it's just so fungible, the ripple effects. I mean, you and I can talk about energy here, but if you go to sub-Saharan Africa, which is suffering right now, in countries or Nigeria or in South Africa where you get rolling blackouts, there's an overwhelming dependency on diesel fuel, biodiesels. Anytime you see this kind of uptick or this shoot up in Brent oil, it disproportionately hurts the poorer countries. It hurts the food supply where grain is being diverted for fuel. You see riots in Sri Lanka actually storming the presidential compound. You see it here in Texas, where you would think Texas, right? Big energy, but you have the state energy provider warning about rolling brownouts.
So international crisis, you can't waste a good crisis, Churchill supposedly said. So is this an opportunity, maybe like the 70s oil shocks, for new, cheaper technologies, innovation? I remember after those shocks, you know, my family ditched the Guzzler and my dad drove me to school in this tiny little VW Rabbit, 48 miles per gallon.
True, but look around you right now. How many ginormous pickup trucks and SUVs do you see on the road, kind of? And is that the last pang for the internal combustion engine? Look, the last time this happened to us in 2008, when oil shot up to $140 a barrel, we had this renaissance in fracking and drilling in the United States. Now that we sense that we are carbon constrained, the solutions are going to be much harder. None of this stuff is 24/7. You need almost a Manhattan project to pursue solar, geothermal, nuclear. Everything has to be in the mix, and it's a national security crisis.
Okay. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
Let's take a closer look at the U.S. housing market and the high costs of buying. A lot of Americans put a lot of money down this past year when they bought houses even before they got built. Okay, so what happens when the house isn't finished and mortgage rates have gone way up? It can be an expensive financial blow, as NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
These days, Ari Brooks is trying really hard not to think about mortgage rates.
I try not to because it gives me a lot of anxiety.
She and her family live just outside of Boise, Idaho, which has turned into one of the toughest places in the whole country to buy a house. People have been moving there in droves, driving prices up 82% in just the past 3 years. So after getting outbid again and again, she and her husband, T.R. Brooks, decided to buy a house from a home builder before it was actually built.
It seemed very attractive in that there's no bidding war. There's a price you agree on, and it doesn't go up while you wait for it to be built.
That was kind of a relief, right? When you sign the contract, it locks the price of the home.
So they signed a contract to buy a house for $430,000. But that was more than a year ago. Pandemic supply chain delays have kept builders waiting on everything from roof trusses to windows and doors. Meanwhile, interest rates have been rising dramatically. The couple is lucky that when rates started rising, they got an 11-month rate lock from the home builder's lending division. Most lenders don't even offer long-term rate locks like that.
We have a rate lock that's in the high threes.
But that expires in a few months now, and their house still isn't finished. Rates have risen to up around 5.5%, so if their rate lock expires, buying the house will get much more expensive. On a $400,000 loan, that adds nearly $500 a month to the mortgage payment. And a lot of new construction homebuyers like the Brookses are getting hit with this price shock now. Kenny Parcell is a realtor in Spanish Fork, Utah.
I mean, this is real life stuff. This is young families, people that were barely getting in before, and the dream of homeownership, and they're watching it go away.
Parcell says he's got clients who also signed contracts to buy homes, and now they can't qualify for a mortgage to buy the same house that they could qualify to buy just 6 months ago.
We've had 10 people we've been working with that are canceling right now. There's a lot of tears shed on, you have real empathy for these people.
He says some families have put down earnest money deposits of $20,000 or $30,000 when they agreed to buy the house, so now they could lose that money.
Some builders are willing to give that back, as to where other builders said, sorry, it was non-refundable.
So he says people are scrambling, lawyering up, trying to get the money back, or trying to borrow money from family to buy the house that way. Meanwhile, he says people are still stuck renting, and many landlords are raising rents too.
Rent prices are so high right now as well. You know, they can't afford to stay in their rental, and they can't afford to lose their construction deposit or their earnest money. They're in a real pickle.
Back in Boise, Idaho, Ari and T.R. Brooks are in better shape. T.R. is a psychology professor and Ari is a social worker, so they have solid incomes. Even if they get hit with that much higher mortgage payment, they could still afford to buy the house, though money would be tight.
We've got a kiddo in daycare full time, and then just with the other sort of rising costs around us.
We also have a car that's a bit of a time bomb.
Yeah,
we're going to need to buy a new car.
We have some expenses coming up.
Meanwhile, they've been saving up all they can so they can put down a bigger down payment if they have to pay that much higher interest rate. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Well, so as we just heard, buyers of new construction are feeling the pinch, but so are owners and renters facing this new reality of a high interest rate. Let's get a broader view of the housing market with Yale economist Robert Shiller. You might know the name from the S&P CoreLogic case Shiller Home Price Index. He's that Shiller. Hi, Professor.
Hi, Robin.
Well, so do you agree, you know, this is all happening because interest rates went up to tame inflation, and mortgage rates shot up as well. But also housing prices were up. And so here we are. Do you agree that's the problem?
It depends on how the public interprets the interest rates. In 2020, people were talking about almost record low mortgage rates. So a lot of people started to think about getting a house. At the same time, there wasn't a big supply of houses. So prices went up a lot. Now the impetus for paying for a house has weakened.
Mm.
The opportunity you didn't want to miss isn't there anymore.
You mentioned inventory. Do you agree with analysts who say that part of the problem is that after the housing collapse, the U.S. got shy about building? We don't have enough of a stock. We didn't build enough homes.
That's right. But building has begun to increase, and there is eventually a supply response. People don't often bring this up, but supply response is what brings prices back down again. This isn't the stock market. This is the housing market, and we can make more of them.
So you're saying that builders will be incentivized to build because of the demand?
That's the way it's supposed to work in a capitalist economy.
Right.
You know, you can make a lot of money building houses until the prices come down.
Right. And the prices will start to come down as the supply widens, but then you curb again the supply until there's demand again. But what is your advice, first of all, for a seller who thought just a few months ago they were going to literally cash in on the sale of their home? They might even get cash from someone competing to buy it. What would you recommend to them now?
Well, if they're trying to make a profit on their home sale, maybe they should move to complete the sale, because the futures market at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is showing expected declines in home prices. The futures prices are now down.
Well, so yeah, if you are trying to sell your home and you don't have, you know, some people have to sell it quickly. They've got to get out of town or what, you know, they need to make the sale for financial reasons. But you're saying don't be thinking that things are going to get back to where they were, where people were throwing cash at homes. Sounds like you're saying, you know, it could actually, interest rates and mortgage rates could go up even higher. Sell now.
Well, of course, it should be mainly for your family and your situation. People like to own homes because it gives them a sense of permanency. They want to develop a community in their neighborhood maybe even get involved in local politics. Those things matter if you have ownership.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have to be practical, and maybe you aren't ready to commit yourself to a long home. And so you might sell now and move toward renting.
Right. And not try to capitalize on a market that's a little wobbly right now. Well, what about a buyer? You know, with the interest rates up, the price of homes up, and the possibility of interest rates going up even more, should you stretch your dollar just to buy now or wait it out?
I wish I knew the answer to that.
Oh, come on.
Interest rates are not low anymore, but they've been higher in other times in history. If you go back to Paul Volcker's, when he was chair of the Fed, you had double-digit mortgage rates. I think these things are hard to forecast.
Yeah.
That doesn't satisfy listeners who want to know what to do, but that's reality.
Right. And as you said, the futures does try to forecast, and it's not looking really good for housing for a little while, at least in the futures market. Robert Shiller, again, of the Case-Shiller Housing Index, do you think the industry was caught by surprise by this 1-2 punch of higher interest rates, higher housing prices, and suddenly a scramble in the rental market?
Well, the market looks kind of extreme. In 1 year, home prices in the United States, according to our index, went up 20.4%.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost unprecedented. You have to go way back. I'm not sure we can find a time when it went up so much in 1 year. And so interest rates were at near record lows, mortgage rates. Those two events are probably related.
Mm.
I think there was a sense of urgency in wanting to lock in the low mortgage rate. And so it created a buyer incentive. At the same time that institutional investors were starting to enter the market.
Yeah. Yale University's Robert Shiller of the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Oh, they're incredible. You can see them at hearandnow.org. The high-resolution color images released today from NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, the largest and most sophisticated telescope ever built, showing us the universe in a way it's never been seen. Galaxies more than 4.6 billion years old, the Carina Nebula, where stars are born, more than 7,000 light years away. My head is having a hard time wrapping around this, so let's bring in Alyssa Goodman, professor of astronomy at Harvard University. Professor, your reaction to these pictures?
Pretty amazing. We've been waiting for a very long time. You know, as an astronomer, I can just look at them and know what they mean. And so yesterday, when President Biden was presenting the image, I was like, oh my God, look at all that gravitational lensing. But I was out on my deck with a couple of friends, and they're like, what are you talking about? And then I realized it's hard for people to appreciate what's really going on.
What are you talking about? Because the pictures yesterday were galaxies being born, you know, all these sharp pieces of light. The NASA Administrator Bill Nelson explained that light travels at 186,000 miles per second. So the light that we're seeing, the sharp, bright images on those little specks, has been traveling for over 13 billion years. Are we going back in time to see it as it's happening? I mean, people have asked me, is it a picture that's still out there floating around somehow? How are we seeing this?
The thing that is so very unusual about the deep field images that Hubble released and now the deep field image from the Webb telescope is that they're showing you many different times at the same time. And so when you look out deep, deep into the universe, you are looking back in time because it took the light such a long time to get here. What's weird about these images and what's so confusing is that you're seeing things that are very close, stars in our own galaxy, galaxies in our own local group of galaxies when you look in the right direction. And then in that field, galaxies that are farther away, but like just reasonably far. But the galaxies in the back, you know, farthest away, are those little tiny smudges that people were so excited about in the image. Wow. Those are at redshifts that correspond, or ages or distances, depending on how you want to look at it, to almost the very beginning of the universe. Oof. And that is bizarre. And,
it
you know,
is.
Galaxies looked different then. And so it's like this mishmash of galaxies of all different ages.
Well,
so it's really hard to appreciate it all at once.
It's well, and, you know, especially we have young people on staff who are like, I've seen all that in CGI, you know, in films, you know. But this is the real thing. And we know the universe goes back 13.8 billion years. We're now at 4.6. And you made a video, we're going to post it at hearandnow.org, compares the images we're seeing now with what we were able to see before this telescope, so people can really look at that. And you also show, you know, you zoom out and you show what you were just saying, what a teeny tiny speck we are looking at. The NASA press release said, this slice of the vast universe covers a patch of sky approximately the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length by someone on the ground. So in these stunning pictures that are light before it's traveled these, you know, billions of years to us, what as an astronomer, what are you seeing?
It's funny that you mentioned the comment about CGI and the young people. So a lot of the work that I do and a lot of modern work in astrophysics compares numerical simulations, so computer simulations of physics in the universe, with real observations. And so we've had computer simulations of things like what you've been seeing today for years, for decades in some cases. But we have not had real images. And so this looked to me like, you know, the better than CGI, okay, better than a simulation, you kind of go, oh my gosh, we actually understand physics? What? You know? And there's still all of this missing physics that we don't understand about dark energy and dark matter and what really happened at the beginning of the universe. None of that is directly addressed by just looking at this image, but you should know that in comparing the detailed calculations in these numerical simulations with the images, questions like that, questions about the distribution of dark matter and the nature of dark energy and all of that, can actually be gleaned from the detailed analysis of the colors and the shapes in those images. And that'll take years.
Yeah, that'll take
years. But people are on it.
But so let's say, you know, we'll pick one of the picture of the Carina Nebula.
I mean, to us, it's this gorgeous, you know, these just different specks and different colors, and there's a sharpness to it. And by the way, the Webb telescope gathers infrared light that can't be seen by the human eye. So this is now what, you know, part of what we're seeing. But as an astronomer, if it, you know, in language we can understand, you said, yes, oh, we had the physics right. But is there something else you're seeing?
To an astronomer, it's actually the details in that image and the level of detail.
Because it tells you what?
If you look very, very carefully at that image, you'll see very light and dark patches right at the edge where the sort of brownish stuff merges into the bluish background, and there's like a sharp edge overall. But then inside the brown and orange region, you see all this structure. That actually has to do with gas that's being shaped by light that's strong enough to do stuff to matter that's coming from outside the star-forming region of dust and gas. All of that conspires to give you those shapes. What the kind of detailed arrangement of all those shapes are actually determines what kinds of stars. So all of those details are going to mean a lot.
To the rest of us, they are just stunning and awe-inspiring.
Yes, that's true, too.
Alyssa Goodman, professor of astronomy at Harvard University. Again, we'll have the pictures and her videos at hereandnow.org. Professor, thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of your day looking at
these
images.
Thank you. We'll be having a great time in the astronomy world. And thanks.
I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.